KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
Cleveland Heights.
West Oakland.
I live in San Leandro now.
Up Beach.
Coming up, a battle over whether police should release misconduct records.
Up until last year, California has done more than almost any other state to keep police misconduct records a secret.
Then the Sundance Film Festival was abuzz about the last black man in San Francisco. We'll hear from the filmmakers.
He's trying to capture the soul of it, though, before they take it away.
And a young singer-songwriter is making waves in the jazz scene.
What makes the sound of my music unique is me being able to be vulnerable to the influences that have sculpted me as a Hapa, as being half white and half Chinese.
Hear that sound today on Cross Currents. For decades, records about police misconduct in California have been kept secret. That was all supposed to change this year when a new law went into effect requiring police to release certain disciplinary records. Journalists have since asked police to hand over hundreds of documents, but police unions are pushing back. KALW's justice reporter Holly J. McDeed is with me in studio to talk about this brewing legal battle. So what's the background for this police transparency law, and why now?
So activists have been pushing for decades to increase transparency in policing, but these calls really reached a fever pitch after the death of Stephon Clark last year in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. Clark was a 22-year-old black man. He was shot 20 times by police in his grandmother's backyard, and minutes after he was killed, police muted their body cameras. So that immediately raised a lot of red flags for activists. And it also ignited this kind of larger conversation about how difficult it is for people to get access to any misconduct records about police. Up until last year, California has done more than almost any other state to keep police misconduct records a secret.
Why does California have all those restrictions?
Well, to understand why, you really have to know just how powerful police unions are as a lobbying arm in California. And you also have to go back to the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So this was at a time where the Los Angeles Police Department was actually destroying tons and tons of police records. So in response to that, there was a law saying that police couldn't do that. They couldn't just go around destroying their records. Mm-hmm. But there was also part of a law that said that those records, no one would be able to access them. No one would be able to see them. So since then, over the years, police unions have really fought to keep those privacy restrictions in place. That is, until last year, when a bill was finally passed saying that police would have to open up some of these misconduct records to the public.
Okay, so you couldn't shred the records, but you couldn't— they wouldn't be available to anybody.
You couldn't see them.
You couldn't see them.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So what does this new law do?
So this new law, it opens up these misconduct records. So this applies to basically three instances. So officers involved in shootings, we can get access to those records.
Okay.
If officers have lied on the job, we can see those records. If officers have committed sexual assault, the public now has access to those records.
Mm-hmm.
However, since this law went into effect this past January, it's been pretty chaotic.
Why? What happened since this law went into effect in January?
So since this law went into effect, there's been a wave of lawsuits filed throughout the state. These are lawsuits being filed by journalists trying to access records,
mm-hmm.
and they're lawsuits being filed by police unions. So what the police unions are saying is basically that this law only applies to records from before the law went into effect in 2019.
So what do you mean? Like, it wasn't clear whether this new law would apply to records from before it was enacted?
Well, that's what's being debated right now. Those are the cases that are playing out in court.
Mm-hmm.
So this came up in Contra Costa County Superior Court last week. There, the judge sided with the journalists against the police union. He said, no, this law applies to all records that police have on file. But legal experts say this whole thing is likely to end up in the California State Supreme Court. Meanwhile, California's Attorney General, Javier Becerra, he says he's not going to respond to requests for records until this is all settled.
Okay, so why do police unions say their records should not be released?
So police unions are basically saying that it puts their officers at risk. They say that if the public learns, say, the names of officers who've lied in the past or committed misconduct in the past, that the public will target them.
Is there an example?
Well, activists managed to learn the name of one of the officers who had shot and killed Stephen Clark. These activists went to that officer's wedding and harassed him there and basically said, well, you're going to remember this moment for the rest of your life. Mm. And they did not apologize for that. But of course, police see that as an example of what can happen when their names get out there in the public.
Right. So are there any police departments that have given up records?
There are. There's dozens of police agencies that have released records.
Okay, so what have we learned from those cases?
Well, so we learned about an officer in Burlingame who basically he offered to help women with their charges in exchange for sex. We learned about another officer in a town in Solano County who had tampered with evidence, who put a suspect in an unnecessary chokehold that could have turned deadly. So we learned about these are just examples of the kind of things we might learn because of this law. These are incidents that the public would have had no way of finding out about before. Mm-hmm. So this really is a big shift.
So what are you following next?
So come July, another transparency bill will come into effect. So that bill says that police are required to release certain officer-involved shooting footage. But given how chaotic this previous transparency bill has been, given how many lawsuits have been filed, it's likely that that bill will face a big fight as well from police unions.
Okay. All right, Holly, thank you.
Thanks, Anna.
Holly J. McDeed is KELW's justice reporter. You can connect with her at justice@kelw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Back in 1990, the census found that 11% of San Francisco residents were African American. A decade later, that number had dropped to about 8%. And by 2010, the city's black population was just 6%. Next year, it's expected to be even lower. Native San Franciscan Jimmy Fales says the exodus sometimes makes him feel like the last black man in San Francisco.
I mean, it just definitely makes me feel like less people to relate to. I mean, there's no black middle class, you know what I'm saying? So it kind of gives, like, to people that are outsiders, you know, they only have one image of black folks. I just feel like the less there is, the more that they can stereotype us.
Fales and his friend, filmmaker Joe Talbot, captured that experience through a new film called The Last Black Man in San Francisco, and it was a hit at the Sundance Film Festival. It's a fictional version of Fales' life. He meets wacky city characters, he brushes off racist encounters, and he tries to make his corner of San Francisco feel like home. While the film was in production, KALW's Christina Loring met up with Joe and Jimmy to talk about their work and about life in the city.
Jimmy Fales doesn't fit neatly into one box. He's a black San Francisco native. His skateboard is like an extension of his body. His acting inspiration is Marlon Brando. And like Brando, he's the star of his own show.
My whole family grew up in that house, you know?
My uncles, my aunts,
my cousins,
everybody.
In the trailer for his new film, called The Last Black Man in San Francisco, Fales skateboards around San Francisco's hilly streets as he tells us his family's story. He's on a quest to buy back the house his grandfather built in the Western Addition in the 1940s.
When I was six, we lost the house. Crack trumped the mortgage that month.
We see Fales' silhouette atop what looks to be Bernal Heights against the backdrop of the Bayview Hunters Point piers, where many black men of his grandfather's generation came to work.
My grandpa came west when there wasn't left down south. sometimes I feel like it ain't nothing left for me here. But where am I supposed to go?
The story of loss he's telling would be familiar to many Black families in San Francisco. But in the film, Fail's real-life narrative veers into fiction as he plots to buy back the home with his quirky, esoteric Black best friend, Prentice. The scheming is fiction, but the best friend part is true. Except in Fail's real life, the partner in crime is a short, scrappy, white filmmaker, his childhood best friend, Joe Talbot.
And this dude right here will argue that Five Guys is better than In-N-Out, but let me tell you, there's no argument.
Talbot also grew up here, and the two of them argue like San Francisco natives.
This is what we say, natives.
See,
this is a dumb native.
No, I'm just telling you right now.
It's an East Coast
chain. No, I'm going to tell you right now. There's no argument.
I meet them in Presidio Park, where they grew up. They first met not far from where we're sitting. Talbot had just gotten in a fight with the larger kid from the Army Street Projects where Fails lived, and had won. The neighborhood kids were upset, but Fails stuck up for Talbot. And then they started to hang out.
I just like kind of kept seeing him around, and we just started hanging out. He always had the camera out, so I was always trying to be around that. You know, he was always making music, hella creative.
It wasn't long before the two friends started making movies together. 10 years later, they seem like an iconic duo.
We us. That's what we is. That's what I'm going to say. We Joe and Jimmy. Yeah. Soon to be, you know, people hopefully one day, we're like Joe and Jimmy.
Even if you didn't know them, they'd stand out. Fails is tall, 6 feet or so. He's wearing his signature knit hat and cool demeanor. Talbot, he's 5'4" and wearing an oversized tweed jacket and an SF Giants hat. They have the same teetering walk. They finish each other's sentences and egg each other on to tell stories.
You should tell your sprinkler story.
My sprinkler story?
Damn.
Could we save that for later? That's a good one. This is just a funny little... All right, I'll tell him a sprinkler story. He got me.
This is Talbot in his typical role of setting Fails up as a storyteller. And for Fails, this is a typical story.
I was walking back home one night, right? And a nice little, you know, hipster dude or whatever was walking. And I was walking behind him. And he was like, you know, I could see him looking back like he was uncomfortable because I was walking behind him. It's late at night. I understand, you know what I'm saying? I'm big and Black, you know what I mean? I'm walking behind him.
He's walking in this exact neighborhood where he's lived for most of his life. The hipster dude crosses the park away from him, and then the sprinklers in Presidio Park turn on.
And he walked through the sprinklers, like, you know what I mean? And I'm from across the street, like, looking, and he's, like, looking at me the whole time while he's, like, getting drenched in the sprinklers. And I'm, like, looking at him just like, okay, like, like, all right. And then we get to the end of the park, and I'm like, and he's just drenched, like, I already know because he just walked through the sprinklers. And I'm like, yo, like, I'm just walking home. Like, I try to yell that to him, and he started running. And I was like, wow.
And I feel like in the film, there are a lot of moments like that that sort of come from those real-life stories of what Jimmy's gone through or friends of ours have gone through.
Fails says he wants the film to get at the broader emotional truth of being an outcast, to be universally relatable to people across the country who are being displaced and seeing their cities change. In San Francisco, that's happening fast.
He's trying to capture the soul of it, though, before they take it away.
They promise the film will have that soul. Talbot and Fails often pull their own unique characters off of San Francisco streets, asking strangers to become actors in their films and celebrating their eccentricity. Sounds good, right? But when I pry for some more details on specifics, the two are tight-lipped about the scenes.
There's one I want to say, but I don't want to say, and then,
The film is still in pre-production, so we'll have to wait to watch those scenes. But while you wait for its release, you might recognize Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails about town. Fails in particular is becoming a celebrity.
The other day, like, some dude went by, and sometimes I forget, so, like, some dude was rolling by, and he was like, Black man! And I was just like, so is you saying Black? Last Black man. That's what he was probably talking. Because I was just like, why would he just yell Black? I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm Black and a man. Okay.
If you see him, maybe just start with hello. For Cross Currents, I'm Christina Loring.
Joe Talbot won the directing award at Sundance earlier this month for The Last Black Man in San Francisco. The film also won a special jury award for creative collaboration. Find more information about the movie at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now from movies to music. While studying classical voice at SOTA, San Francisco's public arts high school, Jamie Z felt drawn to jazz. The genre's nonconformist ethos seemed to mirror Jamie's experience as half Chinese, half white, bisexual, and non-binary. Now she's studying at the California Jazz Conservatory in Berkeley and composing music that reflects her identities. Jamie came by KLW Studio to talk about her musical journey for Bay Area Beats.
Music has a lot of rules that they teach you. It's like, here's these four bars, and there's four beats that fit into each one, and everything's very mathematical and scientific, and it all makes sense. But when you really start playing the music, anything can happen. Something's killing me. You make one big motion, you change my emotion, or what you do. My name's Jamie Z. I'm a singer from the Bay Area. I was born in San Francisco, and I've been into music and the arts my entire life. I was exposed to a little bit of jazz when I was younger, but it was mostly like smooth jazz, like elevator music, you know? And so I don't think it was all the juicy stuff yet, like Lester Young or Ella. Maybe some Ella like was slipped in there, but from what I remember as a kid, it was like a lot of Chinese music, like Jackie Chan singing. In school, they would show us these kung fu movies and all these martial arts movies as like a lesson. They'd be like, this is, you know, the actors of our people, and this is our martial arts. It was just interesting to hear this music that your family knows, that you're, you know, that you guys karaoke to all the time, and you know, it was just a good feeling. I was trained in high school as a classical singer, and before that I pursued musical theater for a little bit. But it wasn't really my thing, and I was looking for something more expressive and more to do with improvising. So some teachers of mine, they reached out to me and they were like, okay, so this guy, John Calloway, he has a Latin jazz youth ensemble in San Francisco that he runs, and you would be great for it. And I was like, first of all, I don't know how to speak Spanish. Second of all, I've never sung in Spanish. Third of all, I know nothing about this craft, and I don't want to butcher it, and I don't want to be disrespectful. So John came to my high school into the cafeteria. It was like really grungy, super gross, you know, like rainy day, and he comes in, sits at the piano, is not looking at me, and he starts plunking away, and he had sent me a song to learn for him, and it was Lágrimas Negras, the first song that I ever learned for him. And we just started playing on the piano together, and I was singing and he was playing. And after we finished the song, he looks at me and says, "Why didn't you learn this earlier? You could have been in the show tomorrow." And I'm like, "Oh my God." I won't tell you to smile for me. Won't you just let me be ordering me to anywhere. what makes the sound of my music unique is me being able to be vulnerable to the influences that have sculpted me as a Hapa, as being half white and half Chinese. And I think that through my music, I'm able to kind of channel this feeling of not wanting to be what anybody else wants me to be. They denied me of my change and made me feel like one big disgrace. I mean, I feel the pressure all the time to kind of be representing some kind of label or like some kind of type of person. Like, oh, you're this and this and this and this, but that's too much, so you have to clear it out a little bit. You can only choose a couple. And I'm like, well, I'm all these things. I'm really complex. I still feel like it's important to remember where we came from. Because although you can have all this formal education and formal training, it doesn't mean that you are any better than some guy on the street who's studying at home, who's studying from his mentor, who's been doing this for the past 80 some years, you know? I don't feel like jazz will ever go out of style, just because it's been in evolution. It's like a butterfly. It's still cocooning. And I feel like no matter what jazz might be, it is always protest song in its purest form. You know, it's obviously been filtered through like a white lens and has been sold as a product. But I feel like jazz is in everything that we do. It's in the soul music that we sing, it's in the church, it's created Latin jazz. It's always fresh and it's always influencing someone else, because you know what? Someone is out there sampling something from a Nancy Wilson record. You know, someone is sampling Cannonball Adderley, someone is sampling Benny Goodman, someone is sampling Herbie Hancock. Everything's influencing us. You know, it's like being a mixed person. I wouldn't be me without all these other ingredients. So why leave that behind?
That was jazz singer and composer Jamie Z. You can hear her perform Thursday night at the Starline Social Club, and that's for a special Valentine's Day themed cabaret show. This edition of Bay Area Beats was produced by Marisol Medina Cadena. And if you want to find out more about Jamie Z and more musicians from around the Bay Area, go to kalw.org. And while you're there, make sure to click Cross Currents to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. This music is by Love Jerks from San Francisco. They're playing at the Rickshaw Stop this Thursday night. She needs a man who will work as hard as he can. Like Tony Danza with a plan. She wants a dude with a can-do attitude. Like MacGyver. Today's team includes Janae Darden, Joanne DeLuna, Sarah Nora Coast, Lisa Morehouse, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega Welch, Eli Wertschafter, and Aaliyah Yates. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Hadil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.